My guest, Michael Harvey, is a first-time crime novelist who spent years exploring real crimes as an investigative reporter and as the co-creator and executive producer of Cold Case Files on the A&E channel. It was one of the first TV programs to focus on solving crimes with forensic science. Michael Harvey earned a law degree from Duke and practiced briefly before getting a master's in journalism and becoming an investigative reporter and TV producer. His novel focuses on a former cop and private eye named Michael Kelly, who gets pulled into an unsolved rape and battery case that leads to revelations of police corruption. The story involves complex relationships between cops, crime victims, prosecutors, and journalists on the streets of Chicago. It's called The Chicago Way. A warning to listeners, one of the real crimes Harvey describes in our interview includes some disturbing details. Well, Michael Harvey, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, the main character in your book, it's who tells us the narrative. There's a guy named Michael Kelly. He's a private detective and a former cop. He's also a guy who loves the classics. He has Plato and Aeschylus around. And I know that you studied classics as an undergraduate. Yes. Is that a bit of you in this guy?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think when you go to create a character, you bring kind of a toolbox with you. And in that toolbox are, among other things, your lifetime experiences. And when you start to look at what these guys really talk about, they're some of the great observers of the human condition in Western civilization. I mean, you're talking about Homer and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Plato and Euripides, and they're often writing about greed and murder and lust and revenge and all of these things that are also in, you know, modern crime novels.
So the cop that sort of sees the worst society has to offer draws on the wisdom of the ages in a way.
Exactly. And for example, in the book, there's a lot from Aeschylus and the Agamemnon. And the Agamemnon in that trilogy of plays is really about revenge. It's about taking the law into your own hands and these blood cycles of you killed one of my relatives, I'm going to kill one of yours. And this goes on for generations and generations in the plays that Aeschylus wrote. And he eventually supplanted that with a system of laws and a system of justice where you could go to society and get justice and you didn't have to take the law into your own hands. And when you flip it forward thousands of years to, you know, the Untouchables and to the Chicago Way, you have people that are not happy with that system and are now going back to, let's take justice into our own hands.
Well, you know, it did strike me that, because I also noticed that in the book, vigilante justice is a real theme here, and not just among victims of crime, but among the people who are supposed to enforce and uphold the law. I mean, cops who actually think about administering the ultimate vengeance on someone. Did you know cops who you thought would do that? I mean, would
I didn't
plug
know cops
somebody
that,
rather than take them to court?
Yeah, I didn't know cops that would actually do it. I think I know cops that would like to do it, and would you know, if you're in the system long enough and you see somebody walk, a lot of these guys are, you know, they get upset about that. I don't know anyone that would actually do it, but it's interesting to think about it and what would push you to take that extra step. And that's what makes for an interesting story.
You know, one of the themes of this book is rape in its many forms and lasting consequences. Was this a particular interest to you, exploring what rape does to its victims?
Yes. Yeah, it was. You know, the crime of sexual assault, you have, honestly, everyone thinks of the crime of sexual assault as the stranger-on-stranger rape where some woman is walking down an alley and is confronted. But you also have a woman who's raped in the context of a 20-year marriage by her husband. A woman who's a sophomore in college who's raped in the context of a date. The uncle who rapes his 10-year-old niece. All of these wide range of crimes are all called sexual assault, and yet they're not at all similar. The motivations aren't similar. The crime patterns aren't similar. They're just not similar. So it's a very complex crime with a lot of different strands to it and a lot of different types of crimes, and yet we call them all sexual assault. And one of the things that I wanted to do was bring out the effects of sexual assault on women and talk about what a complex crime it is. And you do that in the context of the novel. You have to keep the novel moving forward, but every now and then you like to try and bring a couple of these social issues sort of to the surface or let them just bubble underneath the surface. And that was sort of what I was trying to do. The other issue in sexual assault that was very interesting to me is the backlog of rape kits that we have in this country. I've walked into evidence lockers all over this country where there are thousands of rape kits sitting up on a shelf, never been looked at. Massachusetts just last week found 16,000 rape kits evidence kits that they didn't even know they had. And these are crimes that...
when we say rape kits, we're talking about the evidence that's gathered, and the physical evidence gathered from a woman immediately after the crime.
Exactly. And a lot of states, they just don't have the money or the manpower to get in to test all of these. And that doesn't help the women who have been sexually assaulted who are waiting for answers. And it doesn't help the fact that these guys might still be out there. In fact, they are. Some of them are for sure. When you have 10,000 rape kits, you definitely have some hits in there. And you definitely have some offenders who are out there probably still offending. And that is a unique circumstance to me, because there aren't many times in the criminal justice system where you know you have the answers there, and yet we just don't have the money and the manpower to dig them out. And we know we have the answers that are bulletproof answers, because you're talking about DNA.
You ended up co-creating and being an executive producer of Cold Case Files on the A&E channel, which, you know, focused on long unsolved crimes which were eventually solved. And I guess it was the first Cold Case Files, and certainly one of the most dramatic that I saw involved. I think it was called The Boy and the Monster, and it really begins with the discovery of a body of a 15-year-old girl. Right? What condition was her body in when it was found?
Well, her body was found abandoned. I can't remember the town, but it was abandoned in a field, and the fingers had been cut off. And one of the reasons why the fingers were cut off, the police knew immediately, was because whoever killed her didn't want this person identified. And what that tells the police is that if we identify this girl, we're probably going to find the killer, because it's probably somebody she knows. And that's a for sure thing when you see a body like that.
So she's buried without identification, and then there's a break in the case, right?
Yeah, there is. They reconstructed a photo of this girl, and they were able to link her to Milwaukee, and they believed that she had been a prostitute. And the first person that they looked at was a person who they believed to be her pimp. And so they go and they go to his house, and they find his young son there. And they start talking to him. And they're actually rolling tape while they're talking to him. And he starts telling them a story about daddy keeping a monster in the cellar. And they're like, well, you know, what are you talking about? And he's kind of telling the story as if it's almost a fairy tale. And they're like, well, why don't you take us down the cellar and show us where the monster is? And so this boy walks them down the cellar and says the monster was right there. And he points up to some pipes near the ceiling. And he starts talking about how daddy had the monster hung up in the cellar from these pipes. And that then the cops are like, well, what happened? What did daddy do to the monster? And the boy says, well, daddy cut off all the fingers of the monster. And he starts, you know, pointing to his fingers, saying he cut off this finger and this finger and this finger and this finger. And he's basically describing a homicide, and he's describing the exact wounds that were suffered by this girl. And the police, obviously, when they hear this, they have the link that they need to this guy. And that's pretty much how they broke the case and put the case together.
We're speaking with Michael Harvey. He was co-creator and executive producer of Cold Case Files on A&E. He has a new detective novel called The Chicago Way. One of the things you had to confront as the producer of these documentaries is how graphic you want the depiction of the crime to be. And there are crime scene photos and other depictions that are pretty disturbing to look at. Mm-hmm. How did you make those decisions?
Well, that's a hard call. I mean, what we tried to do, one of the first premises of the show was not to do recreations and not to use actors or anything like that, which a lot of other nonfiction series use. And that's okay, but we just wanted to use real cops and real evidence and sort of the real thing. But we always tried to be, what we always thought was, the first few seconds, the opening moments of our show are often the last few seconds of someone's life. And we tried to always honor that and treat them with the respect that they certainly deserve, and that the family, if we're talking about a homicide, and the respect that the family members of the homicide victims deserve, because we would often talk to them as well. And we would talk to them about how we were going to use certain photos, and there were lots and lots of photos that we wouldn't use. But we would often talk to family members about, well, we might use this photo, we might use that, have you seen this before, and are you okay with that? And that was often a litmus test for us in terms of what we would actually use.
When we look at most of the cold case files, I mean, these are cases where a crime has been solved, and the police have done hard work, and prosecutors have been committed to the case, and they get the credit they deserve for solving a crime and bringing justice to victims. But, mm-hmm. you know, so many people who have contact with the criminal justice system, both, you know, as victims of crime and in other roles, find that it doesn't work well, that cops yeah. don't sometimes get on the case and things do get lost in the shuffle and legal technicalities screw things up and people who ought to be monitored on parole aren't. And, I mean, I know you're a storyteller and not a mm-hmm. policymaker, but as you do these, I wonder, are you ever thinking that there are that this system is in serious need of some reforms? Are there priorities that you think are the things that need to be done to make it better?
One of the things, the name of my novel is The Chicago Way, and what The Chicago Way is about in some form or fashion is taking the law into your own hands and revenge. And that's what people resort to when they feel like the system isn't working. And you kind of hear that a lot, that, well, you know, the police aren't going to do anything, or even if this guy goes to trial, he's not going to get what he deserves. I think that the system, you know, it's not a perfect system. You know what, I'll give you another good example, a cold case that we did with Jerry Elster. This is a really good example of
the
system not working.
Yeah,
system not working, and someone working within the system to make it better. She was sexually assaulted, and six plus years after she's assaulted, she gets a call saying that we've identified the person who raped you. We have a DNA match to this guy, and he's just about to get out of jail, but he's going back in jail because we're going to charge him with your rape and put him away, you know, forever or for a long time. And she's, you know, she's ecstatic. And then it was like a week or a month later, she gets another call, and they tell her, oh, you know what, we can't prosecute this guy because the statute of limitations has run on the crime. And so it's too late to prosecute him. In fact, we have to let him go. So they've identified the guy. They've told her that they've identified the guy. And now they're telling her, we're going to release him back into society. And she, instead of getting angry, instead of getting bitter, I'm sure she had some initial anger, but instead of just hiding in her room, she decided to change the law. And Jerry Elster was instrumental in changing not only California's laws, but laws across the country, so that now in most states they have a DNA exception to the statute of limitations in sexual assault cases, which essentially says that anytime you get a forensic match, a DNA match on a rape, even if it's 20 years after the crime was committed, you have a period of time, usually a year, in which to bring the case. And so now that will never happen again. It doesn't help her. It didn't help her with her case. But, you know, she took matters into her own hands, worked within the system, and helped to change it. And she's a remarkable person. And those are the kinds of stories that, you know, you just love to do.
The stories that you tell are really dramatic ones. And Americans have sort of seen a lot more shows which depict the criminal justice system as it really happens. And then there are the cops shows that actually follows police on what they do. I'm wondering, do you think this whole realism and look at actual law enforcement and courtroom dramas have changed the way Americans view crime and law enforcement?
That's a good question. I do, in the sense that I think they think it's a lot easier than it is in many ways, because of CSI and because of a lot of the fiction that's out there. As I said, you have to telescope events to create a dramatic premise often in CSI and in novels as well. And so they think it's a lot easier than it is. It's very painstaking. It's a lot of legwork. It's a lot of patience. And it's a lot of take one step forward and two steps back before you actually make the case. And people don't want to hear about that because it's kind of boring, but that's really the way it is.
And sometimes you don't find them.
And sometimes you don't find them, right. And sometimes you find them and you can't prosecute them. That happens too. And that's very frustrating for people. But it's like, you know what? I know this happens a lot. A cop will say, I know this guy did it, but I just don't have the case. And I have to wait. Because you only get one bite at the apple when you charge somebody. And you better have the best case you can. So sometimes they'll have enough, they think, to maybe get a conviction, but they're not quite sure, and yet they don't want to charge somebody because if they charge them and they lose, they don't get a second chance if some stronger evidence, for example, some stronger forensic evidence comes along. So often they'll sit on a case, even though they know that they have the guy or they're pretty sure they have the guy. It takes a lot of discipline to not only bring the right case, but to bring it at the right time.
Well, Michael Harvey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay.